Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. Trying to get myself all logged in and squared away tonight. Hoping that my co-host, Red Beckman, will be joining us. Red, you're not on with us yet, are you?
I'm
here.
All right.
Hey, Red. Have you been back from the rally very long, or do you just...
I've been back for just about an hour, I guess. Yeah, we saw a lot of rain, and that really put a damper on everything. But I was real glad that I was able to go. I haven't seen that many umbrellas for quite a while, and a lot of people got wet. But it was well worth it, and of course I got to meet our friend Steve Pigeon. You know, I've talked to him on the phone and on the program here, but I got to meet him in person, and I was impressed before, but I'm even more so impressed at this point. I couldn't help but think we really need Steve and Pigeon to lecture the U.S. Supreme Court.
You say what now about the Supreme Court?
I think that Steve Pigeon should be lecturing the U.S. Supreme Court. I think he should be explaining to them their proper authority and what they should be doing.
Well, someone sure needs to do it, and I guess Steve's as good as anybody I can think of.
I'll tell you, he is very blunt. He was blunt on the program the night that he was on with you and all. He was blunt, but he's even more so at this point. I just haven't heard anybody that could come out and spell it out the way he did today at that meeting, at that rally. He is not one bit bashful about, you know, explaining to the American people that this government is absolutely corrupt and it has to go. That's all. It just cannot survive its mistakes. And he didn't say it, but I'm going to say it. It is only a matter of time, and the federal government is going to go down. I don't think there's any question about it.
You still there, Red?
I'm here. I'm okay, waiting for you.
Well, tell us a little bit about. Well, it got so quiet. I didn't know if you had dropped or something.
Well, you're used to me talking too long, and I'm trying to cut that short because I don't want to just end up being, you know, a voice lecturing people, and I just don't want to do that. And
Red, before we introduce our guest, who is already online holding, I'd just like for you to give us a little bit of an idea of what this rally was, where it was today, and did you see Darren Stevens?
Yes, I spent quite a little time talking with him. He picked up a carton of 90 books of Walls in Our Minds. He has read the little book twice since Christmas, and he's sold on that little book. And, of course, Darren, the people from Spokane were the best represented there. They got on the bus at 5 o'clock this morning, and they were in there before noon. And they had two busloads, about 85 people came from the Spokane area. And I don't think that Seattle had that good of a representation. But, of course, it was raining pretty hard in the Seattle area, and that really discouraged a lot of people from coming today because... as we went north, it wasn't raining here in the Longview Kelso area where we're at. It wasn't raining here when we headed north going to Olympia. And it wasn't until about, 10 miles or so before we got to Olympia that we started hitting the rain. And the farther north we went, the heavier it got. And so... this was on the Capitol steps, and of course, I'm sure they'd had to have a permit and all, and they had some outstanding speakers. They had some of their state representatives, and of course, this was all about state sovereignty, the 10th Amendment, and I have a hunch that... the 2010 elections are going to change the complexion of the legislature in Washington, state of Washington, because the liberals and such they control the House and Senate, of course, but they just continue want to spend money, and the one. Speaker brought out how that they just can't seem to understand that when you're in a recession that you don't raise taxes when you've got a recession going on, and you really should be cutting government expense and cutting it drastically. And they just I don't know what it is, but there's a psychosis there when. These liberals and such, when they get into power, they just seem like they can do all these kind of things. And, of course, that's what's gotten the state of California in as much difficulty as it is because of the politicians in the state legislature just keep spending money that they don't have. And, you know, that's quite a trick. I can't do that. It's just amazing how that... these politicians, the governor wants another $750 million. That this, she says, there's $750 million that they have to raise for this next session, or at this session that's in process right now. And where are they going to get it with the unemployment rate that they have? It just doesn't make any sense, and so I look for major upheavals in the elections in 2010. It has to happen because there's an insanity involved here, where these politicians they just can't seem to understand that when you're in a recession there isn't that much money floating around that they can get their hands on. And of course, one of the big things that's really happening, and I think it's all over the country, the county and city governments are raising the penalty for speeding tickets, traffic violations, and such, and they're using that as a source of revenue. And I can't think of a better way for them to, anger the citizens than raise speeding tickets up there over $200 And boy, I'll tell you, you've got to be very, very careful, because if they get their hooks into you, they're going to take you for everything that they can, and it's really causing people to wake up.
Well, I think we better get our guest online with us here. Gary Fielder, are you online?
Mr. Dodd, how are you? Mr. Beckman?
Hello, yes. Gary. I'm doing great. And
you know,
I want to tell everyone.
Terry, this is really a great situation for me, because here I get to visit with Steve Pigeon up there today in Olympia, and then I get on the same program with another attorney that is really into this sovereignty thing. My goodness, what a lucky day for me.
Well, it's a lucky day for me, too, and I, Mr. Beckman, you and I have never met personally, but I can't wait to do so.
Well, we'll
you
probably
just missed
get...
each other. You just missed each other in St. Charles.
Yeah, I understand that, yes. But it may happen, because the more excitement here that I get exposed to here, and that's what you sense when you're in a crowd like we were there today, even in the rain. You sense an excitement there, and I get so amused at these signs, the innovations and the ingenuity of the American people when they start making signs. It's quite an education.
Well, I'd like everyone to know that Gary is both a criminal and a constitutional attorney in Denver, Colorado. If you've seen the lecture, online lecture through We Are Change Colorado, called "The Gig Is Up" on the Federal Reserve and fractional reserve banking and the derivative bubble, that was Gary Fielder that did that. It was a masterful lecture, and I'm really looking forward, Gary, to your lecture on sovereignty that's coming up here at DU Law School of Law on January the 30th. And Gary, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. And I'm going to give you the floor, Gary, and let you tell the folks what's coming up here and what you got on your heart.
Well, thank you very much again, Mr. Dodd, Mr. Beckman. Thank you. Feel free to interrupt if you have any need for clarification or questions. I'll just start by saying this. When I first started to wake up, my story is probably very similar to many others. For me, like so many others, it was after 9/11. I'm ashamed to admit that after that tragedy, I began to, develop a prejudice against Muslim people. I fell into the trap of the propaganda, and it was only 2 or 3 years later, I would say maybe 2004, 2005, that I began to wake up to the fact there were a lot of questions associated with that particular event, which led me to dig further. Now, that story I told in short form has probably been shared by literally millions of people. And you don't get too far into your research when you become interested until you start stumbling across the issues concerning the money-making powers of our country, and the influence that the money-making powers have, and exactly what money is, and how we sort of manufacture it, and so when I started to get into the Federal Reserve, I started to figure out what fractional reserve banking meant, the fact that literally all of our tax dollars, I mean, we have a huge IRS tax code that even as a lawyer of 20 years, I can't read, I can't make heads or tails of it. And so you just struggle all year to try to get your tax situation squared away and to get into this particular bracket and to make sure that all of your deductions are in order and on and on and on. But it doesn't really matter, because the bottom line is 100% of what you pay is just going to service the interest on the debt. You're agonizing to throw a drop into an ocean. That's what you're agonizing over. So I'm not here to say anything about that other than that woke me up. And it made me look at other events in my life, and it made me think about what I had been spoon-fed through the media and through other, educational experiences that I've had, going to college, going to law school, being a practicing attorney, watching the criminal justice system at work. A lot of things started to crystallize in my mind. And so the further and further I got down the rabbit hole, the more petrified I became, to a point where I was really, really, like Red said, fearful of where my country was going and where it had already gone, because by the time 2006, 2007 rolled around, we were clearly in a situation where there was no turning back. We've gotten ourselves into such a debt crisis. We've gotten ourselves so over the barrel to China and other other creditors, that there just is no way out. There's no way out of it. There's no way out. So when it hit last year, as the election was getting closer, and everybody was, looking for change, and at least on our side, we were hoping that Ron Paul had a chance, and realizing early that that was probably not going to be in the cards, trying to figure out whether or not McCain had a chance, trying to figure out whether Mr. Obama was the answer or not, this bailout just seemed to come out of nowhere, that all of a sudden our president was on the television telling at least patriots what we knew was coming for a year and a half. I mean, I knew that this was coming down the pipe. Terry, you knew. Red, you knew. This was to us just, common knowledge. But for the rest of the country, this was a big surprise for a president to be on the television talking about going into a Great Depression and having politicians stand up and say, if we don't do this, we're going to be in martial law, or we're going to have complete financial collapse. It was at that time that many of the people that I'm sure that, we've all been talking to started to look at me and say, hey, all that stuff you've been talking about, I kind of see it now, And I remember here in Denver, our own representative, our own Denver representative to the House, who's never on the radio, who never really makes TV appearances. She came on KOA, her voice shaking, talking about how this legislation, this bailout, must be passed. And I'll never forget Dave Logan saying, well, we've taken a poll here in Denver, and it's just an informal KOA poll, and it's 85 to 15. 85 no, and 15 yes, although my opinion was probably 15 hell no. But it was 85 to 15. You never get consensus like that. You don't get the population to fall on one side that large on any issue. And she didn't even blink an eye and proceeded to tell the radio audience how wrong 85% of the people were and how this had to be done. So that just set me off. That set me into motion. And that was the beginning of the Gig Is Up and 2 months of work trying to get that presentation together. And on December 4th, when we actually had the cameras ready and were ready to go, it was a driving snowstorm. The people that actually made the trip up to Boulder and participated in the filming and were there as sort of a live audience, we had 50 or 60 people show up, and that was extraordinary. It was free, and although you can't really tell on the finished product, I stopped many times, I made mistakes many times, and we started and stopped and made it sound good, and the studio audience there was very kind, and it was a wonderful experience. And that really got me up to speed with the major problem that we have in this country. Because the big question has always been, well, why would any entity try to destroy this country? Why would anyone be against us? Why would another country be against us? Why would international bankers be against us? It just doesn't make any sense. When you understand money and you understand sovereignty, it makes complete sense. This country is special. I know every country likes to think that they're special, but this country ultimately is special in the sense that the people are the sovereigns. The sovereignty rests in the people, therefore the people are the sovereigns. So when you're in Europe, in Asia, in Russia, and, you know, your sovereigns total maybe 50 people or 50 countries or however it works out, you're looking over at millions of sovereigns across the Atlantic Ocean. Millions of sovereigns. That's not what the sovereigns of Europe want. They don't want us to be sovereign. They want us to be just like their people. They want us to be subjects. I'll pull up short of saying using the word slavery, and I'll explain that in a minute. But I'll pull up short just barely of using the word slavery. But most certainly, we're supposed to be their subjects. We're supposed to be obedient. We're supposed to know who the rulers are, and we're supposed to bow down to them, and everybody knows that that's not the case. So after I finished the gigas up and got it up on the internet, which took all the way to January and took a little couple months off, I started to pour my research into this issue of sovereignty because I was searching, Terry, I was searching for an answer to the problem. And that's when you and I met and, you know, we have been at a couple of functions together. And I realized that different people in the Patriot community each sort of have their thing. I think the people that sort of have a natural vein for protest, I love that. I think that's part of the answer. I think that people that have a natural vein for politics and leadership, great. They should go in that area. I think people that like to write and research, everyone sort of plays their role. But I couldn't come up with a solution. Petitioning the government didn't seem to even... that didn't even seem to get anyone's attention. Elections seem to be hopeless. Ron Paul is as good as it gets, and he couldn't get 10% of the Republican vote, much less of the country's vote. Elections just seem to be out of the question. There did seem to be a method that seemed to have promise if we all focused on our local elections, and I think that's probably a little bit of what Red saw today. I think people are finally starting to realize that the election for sheriff, the election for your local DA, the election of your mayor, the election of your state representative, or you know your state senator, we need to stop poo-pooing those and stop worrying about who's going to be our president and really focus on the types of elections that we can win. But that still did not seem to be the answer to the question. Until I came across some research which was provided to me by my mentor, a researcher by the name of Larry Hall, and he turned me on to some Supreme Court cases and treaties, and we studied the Declaration of Independence and the Articles of Confederation, and I really became convinced that when we founded the country, the concept of sovereignty was real. The king was the sovereign. That issue of sovereignty had to be dealt with. And for the framers, the ultimate framers of the Constitution, who were at that time participating in the Continental Congress and participating in their own states' constitutions and the Articles of Confederation, knew that the only real true answer back then, which is somewhat similar to ours, was to spread the sovereignty among the people. Not in the body of the people, not in this amorphous, you know, thing called the people, but to the people, to the individual people, meaning that if you were a part of the people, you were a sovereign. Now, those people weren't used to being sovereign. Those people were used to being subjects. But ultimately, John Adams knew what a sovereign was. Thomas Jefferson knew what a sovereign was. Alexander Hamilton knew what a sovereign was. George Washington knew what a sovereign was. They knew they were sovereign. John Jay knew what a sovereign was. He knew he was sovereign. If you were a landowner, you knew you were sovereign. And so there was a sort of a unspokenness about it, if that's a word. You didn't shout it to the rooftops that you were sovereign. You understood it, you knew it, and you lived it. Because being a sovereign is not just being the king. Being the sovereign is being a responsible, duty-filled person. And that's the way it was. And that's the way it continued until our even our individual sovereignty was eroded through time. Now, when I say that the people are sovereign, it begs the question as to who are the people. And this is where some controversy exists, but I'm now convinced in my legal research that the people were the people on the land at the time of the Revolution. Even in the Declaration of Independence, the document talks about when one people are to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another. It was clear that at that time, the people who had come over to this nation had formed a national identity. They weren't just subjects of the British Empire. They were a people. They were their own people. They were a distinct people. They were one people. And when those people, through their representatives, dissolved the political bands which connected them to Great Britain, they became a people. They became the sovereign people. And those people went to war, and they won. Now, how they won, I don't know. And that's the subject for, lengthy books. But we won. And ultimately, we signed a treaty. We signed the Treaty of Paris. And the king put his pen to ink and granted sovereignty to 13 states. And that's a big deal. The states were granted the sovereignty from the king. Now, if you look up the word state in the Black's Law Dictionary, state is defined as a people in a particular boundary who have come together to form a government. Soon after the Constitution, and we'll get back to the Constitution, but soon after the Constitution, in George Washington's first term as president, there's a famous Supreme Court case called Chisholm v. Georgia. And in that case, John Jay, who is a signatory to the Treaty of Paris, who was there and negotiated the peace with the king, explained in the case, which is 1793, we're talking about the Supreme Court of the United States in 1793, Chisholm v. Georgia, written by John Jay, who was at who was in Paris negotiating that treaty, explained it right down the line that when the king essentially gave up his sovereignty to this country, it did not devolve upon the fictitious states, but it went to the people of those states. And in that decision, it is as clear as pie that the people, became the sovereigns without subjects. And so between the Declaration of Independence, between the Articles of Confederation, which, as I will establish in my presentation, actually provides a definition of the word people, which is not necessarily everyone on the land. The word people essentially meant landowners, but technically meant everyone except vagabonds and fugitives. And those are legal words which you can find in Black's Law Dictionary. So, in the end, the people who were on the land, the people who had fought the war, the people who took on the king and won, the people who were standing there when the sovereignty was bestowed, those people are sovereign. And so when we look to the ultimate Constitution, when we look to the preamble of the Constitution, and we see the first three words, we the people, it could easily read, we the sovereigns. Of course, it doesn't read that. And even in the Chisholm case, Justice Wilson talked about how that issue of sovereignty wasn't talked about. It wasn't screamed from the rooftops. It was understood that the people were sovereign. So when the Constitution was created and ultimately ratified, that was the people, the sovereigns, creating a government. That's what the sovereigns do. A sovereign creates. A sovereign passes law. A sovereign is where the power of law comes from. And I don't have the Constitution in front of me, but it's, in order to, ensure domestic tranquility, ensure the blessings of liberty, so on and so forth, to ourselves and our posterity, we hereby ordain the following Constitution for the United States of America. So we're talking about sovereigns who were entering into a constitution for themselves and their posterity. It's probably not politically correct, but at that point, once the country was established, even the Constitution recognized that immigrants would come over, that people would migrate, that some people would come over here against their will. Some people would be transported over here as slaves. Now, at that point, slaves clearly did not have legal standing. But to think that the blood was spilt, that the war was fought, that the treaties were signed, that the Constitution was created, drafted, and ratified, so that thereafter, God bless them, but thereafter, you could just get on a boat and go be sovereign. That's not the way it worked. You could get on a boat and come over, but you'd have to fill out some paperwork. You'd have to go through the state's naturalization process, and each state had their own. The Congress had the power to regularize those naturalization requirements. But if you came over, you were welcome. You could be a state citizen. As a state citizen, you were afforded certain rights that you weren't afforded in any other country in the world. I would venture to say that if some of you can trace your heritage to relatives of yours who came over in 1820 or 1830 or 1840, I would venture to say that when they got off the boat, they got on their hands and knees and they kissed the ground. I would venture to say they were the happiest people on the face of the earth because they were still alive and they made it. They made it to a free country where they could start all over again. But their blood was not spilt. They were not on the land at the time the treaty was signed. They were not there to form a country. And with all due respect, those individuals were not sovereign. They were state citizens. They had all the rights of a person. And a person is a person under the law, and they have inalienable rights too. But sovereignty, where the power comes from, where it resides, who was granted it, Those were the people on the land. Those were the people on the land. And even when you get into the case of Dred Scott, which is, I know, now an infamous case, but even critics admit that the decision, although seemingly inhumane, was legally correct. That at that time, black people weren't really even considered persons. They were considered property. Now, that's an abomination, I understand that. But at that time, that was the law. And the Supreme Court was following the law in the Dred Scott decision. But if you read the Dred Scott decision, which is very well written and very lengthy, it would take you some time. Again, I don't have my notes in front of me. I think it's Chief Justice Taney. I'm sort of guessing at that. But he goes into specific detail of exactly what I'm talking about. I'm not making any of this up. This is not my opinion. This isn't something I've surmised. This is the law. In fact, what I'm talking about is just the rule of law. I'm not talking about sovereignty in a religious sense. I'm not talking about sovereignty in a philosophical sense. I'm talking about sovereignty in a legal sense. And if you read the Dred Scott case, it specifically outlines how the country was formed, how at that point there was really no such thing as a citizen of the United States. But if that term meant anything, it meant one of the people. It meant one of the sovereigns. And in that case, it specifically states that once the Constitution was formed and the country was created, that door was closed. And the only door that was open was state citizenship. Unfortunately, that door was not open to black people. And because they weren't either part of the people or state citizens, they had no standing to sue, or for that matter, be sued in court. And Dred Scott's request for relief was denied. Well, soon thereafter, you know, we engaged in a bloody civil war, and thereafter, the Civil Rights Act of 1866, and then the ultimate 14th Amendment, I believe that was 1868, was ratified, and the rules all changed. I go into detail on that, and we can talk about that here in a little bit. But you know, that created a whole new ball game, if you will, with regard to citizenship. And of course, the 14th Amendment was necessary for a couple of different reasons. First, to establish citizenship for freed black slaves, and to establish a federal citizenship for many, many millions who were undocumented, who had gotten to this country by hook or crook, and for whatever reason hadn't gone through the process of state citizenship. So there were other reasons other than the citizenship of freed black slaves to ratify the 14th Amendment. But the Supreme Court has stated that that particular amendment did not create any new citizenship status for those who were already here. People who were already here, whether they were state citizens or sovereigns, they didn't have to sign up for anything. They didn't have to run down to their local government and fill out their new citizen of the United States paperwork. They were already on the land, and the people who were still here, the posterity of the people who were sovereigns on the land at the time, it was their children, and that sovereignty was passed on, and that sovereignty has been passed on all the way down. And for those for those who might be a little upset, let me say two things. First of all, it is also my heartfelt and legal opinion that the freed slaves although I'm sure at that time they must have felt it was an enormous benefit to be a citizen under the 14th Amendment. It was an enormous benefit to be able to contract, to be able to buy land, to be able to sue, or for that matter even be sued, at least you're a person. I don't think that served black people well. I think that black people who can trace their lineage at least to some time in the 19th century, in the 1800s, have a legitimate claim to the sovereignty that I'm speaking about. Because in the end, they were on the land too. They were on the land since the 1600s. They built the White House. They built the roads. They worked the plantations. They built this country, and they deserve every bit of sovereignty, which was stolen from them, quite frankly, in the 14th Amendment. If you're an immigrant and you came over and you enjoyed the blessings of this country, something had to be worked out. And if state citizenship wasn't working and there was sort of a need for a federal citizen, so be it. But black people in this country, they spilled their blood too. And they were here. Now, they can't trace their lineage as easy as white people can, because the census, the way I traced my lineage straight back to the early 1700s from many aspects of my family, for black people that would almost be entirely impossible. Because once they got back to 1880, 1870, 1860, I've seen the census. Black people were just marks on a page, just a little mark. No name. There were marks of male, female, and number. That's it. So because it's almost impossible for them to do it, and again, this we go into the citations and the international law and the different, you know, legal citations to make this point. But in the end, black people have an easy road to establishing themselves on the land before the Constitution, because there just has to be a presumption. You know, even if you watch the movie Roots, if you watch the very end of the movie Roots, which I just recently watched, Alex Haley sort of goes through how he got to Kunta Kinte. And there were so many different family names and different marriages. And then this person married this lady, and then this lady had a son, and that son married this lady, and this lady married that man. But it all went directly back. It all went from Alex Haley to Kunta Kinte, however it got there. So that's what I would suggest for people who are listening to me and wondering if any of their relatives were on the land at that time. I would venture to bet a couple of things. I'd venture to bet that a crazy uncle has probably already figured out your whole family tree. Everyone's family has that one relative that's already done all the work. When you get into your family and you start understanding your own history and your own heritage and your own bloodline, you have to remember that your surname is only one avenue. Your mother's maiden name is only one avenue. You have four grandparents, and they have four different names. You have eight great-grandparents. That's eight different names. You have 16 great-great-grandparents. You have 32 great-great-great-grandparents. That's 32 different names. So just like Alex Haley did, trace your history. Find somebody that you can cherish. Find somebody that was on the land. Understand who those people were. Find out how they came over here. Find out where they lived. Did they live in Virginia? Were they standing on the land at the time of the Treaty of Peace, at the Treaty of Paris? Because if they were, and they weren't a vagabond, they weren't a fugitive, then they were sovereign. And you are a direct blood relative of a sovereign, which makes you a sovereign. I'm sorry, there's no other way to get around it. And so out of the 128 relatives, if you go back to, I think, great-great-great-great grandfather or grandmother, I was able to quite easily, through Ancestry.com and some other relatives of mine, figure out that out of the 128 possibilities, I could verify that 122 of them were on the land previous to the Constitution. And I'm just a regular person. I'm just a regular guy. I'm just a regular old dude on the land. I'm not special, but after my research and after I've researched my family history, I'm quite proud to say that my ancestors fought for this country, that I could trace many of them that fought actually in the Revolutionary War, those people were sovereign, and they passed that sovereignty down. And somewhere along the line, my great-grandfather bought some land in Texas, moved his family out to Texas. My grandfather worked, my dad worked, but somewhere along the line, you know, my parents signed a birth certificate. Somewhere along the line, I registered to vote and checked the box and said I was a U.S. citizen, which we'll get to here in a little bit. And there's some argument that I gave away my sovereignty, or that doesn't exist anymore, or that's old law. You know, we're all U.S. citizens now. And I disagree with that. If you're a sovereign, you can reclaim it. You can proclaim it. You can declare it. And it's quite a process, but and it's an individual process. I'm not here to tell anybody what to do. But once a sovereign, always a sovereign. Sovereigns passed on through blood. And so that's the basic foundation of it. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that as a sovereign, quite frankly, I mean, I'm just, it almost sounds weird to say, but I'm just telling you the law. Sovereigns don't have to bow to statutes, rules, and regulations. Sovereigns bow to the Constitution because the sovereigns created it. Sovereigns bow to the common law because no man is above the law. And that's really all the Magna Carta ever really stands for. No man, not even the king, is above the law. So you can't run around and say, I'm sovereign, the laws don't apply. No, you still can't hurt anybody. You still can't steal people's property. You still can't trespass. You still can't murder. You still can't assault. But that's hurting somebody. So as a sovereign, you still have great duty and great responsibility. But for the king to have to go down and put little stickers on his car so he can drive his car without getting harassed, for the king to have to go down and beg for a driver's license, for a king to have to give away how much of our wealth, Mr. Dodd, Mr. Beckman, 70% of our of the money that we get, whether it's income or not, to some form of tax all along down the line, sales tax, gas tax, income tax, state tax, property tax, tax. Not to mention the built-in tax of how everything's higher. If you buy a $10 hamburger, you're going to get taxed on that $10 hamburger. But the reason it's $10 is because the hamburger joint got taxed, and then the meat distributor got taxed. So even out of a retail item, you're probably paying $4 or $5 of built-in tax, passed on tax. The sovereign can't be taxed. The sovereign doesn't pay tax unless the sovereign wants to pay tax. The sovereign is the sovereign. The sovereign can participate in a program if he or she wishes to. The sovereign can opt out of a program if he or she wishes to. So if a sovereign were to find out that his hard-earned money was going to just serve the interest on an uncontrollable and quite frankly, inappropriate debt, and the sovereign has that choice to make. Now, again, I'm not trying to suggest that anybody engage in any activity that might get them in trouble. I'm just telling you what the law is. So, that's the answer to me. I mean, that's the answer. That's the only thing that worked. That's the only thing that seemed to pin my shoulders back, you know, and to lift my chin up. Because the first part about being a sovereign is the consciousness of being a sovereign. There's a slave consciousness, there's a subject consciousness, and there's a sovereign consciousness. And so, you know, even though you may not have torn up your driver's license yet, or you may not have decided to opt out of the Social Security program, I'm not telling anybody to do that. I'm not telling anybody to do anything. But once you understand this concept, then you at least start feeling better about yourself. Then you realize that a lot of the things that you thought you knew, they sort of make sense. Terry, how do we protect the individual from either our city government, which can harm you just as much as the federal government, from our county government, from our state government, from any government, if we're just out here trying to win elections. Is that really the only right the sovereign has, is to vote? No, the only way to truly protect the minority, and I don't mean racial minority or a minority of 48%. I'm talking about the minority of the individual. How do you truly protect the individual without sovereignty? Otherwise, we're just subject to whatever the judge says we are subject to. We're subject to whatever the police officer says we're subject to. We're subject to whatever our state house says we're subject to. We're subject to whatever our city councilman says we're subject to. But if you're sovereign, the city council doesn't tell you to do anything. If you're sovereign, your state government, which you created in your state as one of the people to protect you, can't come out and grab you and jail you because you didn't file a piece of paperwork, because you didn't give up your wealth to them. No, that would be repugnant. That would be repugnant to international law and custom. The sovereign doesn't get hurt by the state unless the sovereign hurts someone else. So that's it in a nutshell. So this is a long road. This is a long road for me. This is a long road for my family. This may take me decades to fully contemplate, to fully understand, and to bring into effect. But it's not an easy road. It's not freedom is not easy business. But I certainly hope to evolve to an intellectual and legal level so that ultimately I can protect my children and I can protect my grandchildren and I can protect my great-grandchildren just like any sovereign would.
You know, Gary?
Yes.
A lot of things have come out in my mind, and I know that, Red, when you started talking about sovereigns relying on their vote at the election booth, he was about ready to jump out of there and take over your talk, because I'm telling you, you want to hear somebody preach about fully informed juries and grand juries, and I'm sure you've heard Red. He believes that the second and third votes, which are in a grand jury or a petit jury, are more important to us as sovereigns than our vote at the ballot box, because he feels like we have the final say on the law as a petit juror, and we have every right to investigate any judge or any politician or anybody out there, anything that's going on, as a grand juror. And there's a lot of power in that. Also, something that you mentioned earlier, you were talking about the blacks, and I wanted to ask you a question before Red jumps in here, because I know he's got a lot to say too. I wanted to ask you about the 14th Amendment, because it seems like during the Reconstruction, of course, the 13th Amendment as we see it today, not the original one that they tucked away in some crack someplace, but the one that they call the 13th Amendment today, and the 14th and the 15th, that were all brought about during Reconstruction. Of course, the blacks perceived the 14th as having conveyed the privilege of citizenship upon them, and they don't realize that really it's just a matter of perception, that that law really didn't change anything for them, that they had that sovereignty available to them. And it was just really a matter of claiming it, the same as it is for each one of us. If we abdicate it, then we give it away. But that's the only way that it can be taken from us, is us giving it away.
And I'm just wondering if in your
research and stuff, you've come across this issue with the blacks and the 14th Amendment.
Well, I think that it was an issue back then. From my research, I found that two of the states, Pennsylvania and New York, were ready to give freed black slaves full rights and privileges of free inhabitants, which we know as sovereigns, you know. And so that was a big deal. I think that was part of the fear, because there were other states that weren't going to go along with the program. And those were states probably not just in the South, but, you know, other states that weren't quite as progressive. And so this was an issue to sort of resolve both the states that were going to try to continue, and they, of course, did try to continue, keep freed black slaves in a second-class situation. And it resolved the states that were going to go too far, quite frankly, and give freed black slaves the first-class citizen status, if you will, of a sovereign. So I think it was, I wouldn't call it a compromise. Quite frankly, I think it's a sneaky way to establish a federal citizen who, by the way, thereafter had to, after the 14th Amendment, a freed black person had to get a marriage license if they were going to marry a white person. They had to, birth certificates had to start being issued so that these new federal citizens could be kept track of, you know. It started a whole new process of thinking about federal citizenship, and I don't think to this day black scholarship has really caught up with what we're, as even patriots at this level, are thinking about. I don't think black scholarship has caught up with it. I've listened to many, many speeches of Martin Luther King. I've listened to many speeches of Malcolm X, and I've read extensively about W.E.B. Du Bois and other black writers. They didn't really seem to hit it. They talked about being a citizen as if it meant having all the same rights and privileges that were at least initially contemplated under the original Constitution. But I think all of us were like that. I know when I was growing up, I just thought we were all U.S. citizens. I just thought we were all the same. I thought immigrants were the same as people who had been here forever, and I thought black people were the same. It didn't really matter. And I think that's kind of where we all went after the 14th Amendment, and particularly on into the 1930s, when a new form of citizenship was created in the term of a statutory U.S. citizen, all caps U.S. citizen. That, I think, is even a different and even lower category than the 14th Amendment, citizen of the United States. At least that's a constitutionally created level of citizenship. But the statutorily created U.S. citizen, that really is all of us. And that's all of us as subjects. That's all of us as federal citizens. That's all of us as underneath and subject to the federal government. So, you know, this was a long process. I can't call it a conspiracy. It's not a conspiracy. It's just the way things went to ultimately ensure that the sovereigns of Europe didn't have to compete with millions of sovereigns over here. They only had to compete with the same subjects which they had enslaved in Europe. They've come darn close to doing it here. And I didn't talk about the juries. Of course, I'm a trial attorney, but I think that is a substantial part of this consciousness. Because if we walked around as sovereigns, if we knew we were sovereigns, and even when the government made us do things we didn't think we as sovereigns ought to be doing, like having to go get a driver's license or register our vehicles or pay property tax or sign a birth certificate or whatever, in the end we could say, no, I'm not going to do that. And we would know that when we went to court, the jury that we'd be looking at would have the same consciousness that we had, but they don't. They have the consciousness of a U.S. citizen. In fact, the first question in a jury trial is everyone here a U.S. citizen? Is that not the first question of any jury trial? Is everyone here a U.S. citizen? And out of a veneer of 80 potential jurors, you get 79 hands. And the one person that didn't raise their hand actually is an illegal alien, and he or she gets excused. So we go back to 100% U.S. citizens. Those are your jurors.
We're up against a one-hour break. Believe it or not, the first hour has already flown by. Boy, I sure have enjoyed listening to your giving us this history lesson. When we come back from this little break, I'm going to give Red just a minute to comment to you, and then we're going to open the phone lines up for questions and comments.
Sounds great.
So hang in there with us. We'll be right back in just a couple of minutes.
Thank you.
Faith of our fathers living still in spite of dungeon, fire, and sword. Oh, how our hearts beat high with joy whene'er we hear that glory. Children's fate, if they like them could die for thee.
Faith of our fathers, holy faith, we will be true to thee till death.
Welcome back to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd with my co-host Red Beckman and our very special guest tonight, Gary Fielder, attorney and constitutional and criminal attorney here in Denver, Colorado. Red, I'm going to give you the floor here, Guy, and I know you got a lot on your mind after listening to Gary for an hour.
Yes, I've been talking about sovereignty for well over 30 years. In this country. And I think that we have to relate and take a look at what the biologists have taught us. They went out in the barnyard and they watched the chickens and they figured out that there was always one chicken that ruled the roost, you might say. He was, that one chicken was the boss in the chicken yard, and there was an order of authority. You had a chicken at the top, you had chickens in between, and one chicken at the bottom that was being pecked on by all the rest. And these biologists, of course, called it the pecking order, and I've called it the order of authority. And I think we have to recognize that our Creator God is the highest authority. He is the sovereign of the universe, and He put us directly underneath Him as, that was the natural. Now, the problem with the European monarchies and such is that they have taught that they have a divine right to be king. And so they put themselves above we the people out here and said that they were sovereign. Well, that didn't fit in here in this country when the founders, when they fought and won the War of Independence, of course, they had gone against the King of England, who thought he had the divine right to be their king. And they defeated the king, and they took the position then, of course, as the sovereign, which he had been claiming. And so we go on down. There's an order of authority. If you have a corporate structure, you will have the order of authority in that corporation. You'll have the CEO, the chairman of the board, and all of this, and it'll all be set up in order by how much authority each level of management has. And so here we are in the situation that we started with back there in 1787 with the Constitution ratification, the ratification of the Bill of Rights in December of 1791. I've brought this out before on these programs. Where in the Constitution does it establish? Where is the fact that we are the sovereigns? Where is it in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that establishes that sovereignty? And, of course, you have to go to the Seventh Amendment, and that's where it tells us that the Seventh Amendment jury, and when they find the facts of a controversy, there isn't a court in the land. That Seventh Amendment jury is the highest court in our land because the decision that they make cannot be reexamined by any court in the land. And so the founders understood the sovereignty there. And, of course, you see, we've got our Creator God, then man, And of course, mankind, we the people, we're at that next level, and that's the grand jury and the trial jury, because the grand jury and the trial jury are both made up of people, representatives from we the people. Well, then the next level is your Constitution. The Constitution, you and I, as sovereigns, God created, as sovereigns over that which is below us, the Constitution is a creation of we the people. And so the Constitution is sovereign over the legislative branch of government, the executive branch of government, and sovereign over the courts, the judicial branch of government. We are to be the sovereign over the law, or the statutes, the rules and regulations, and such that are created by the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government. All of the products of their deliberations and such are below them, and so they're right at the bottom of this pecking order or this order of authority, And so we, the people up there at our level, these are all our creations. The Constitution is our creation. We created that Constitution, and the Constitution is a creator. It is a creative law in that it created the executive, the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government. And we, at our level, it is our responsibility to maintain control of that which we have created. And we haven't done that because we did not protect our minds. We did not protect the minds of our children, our offspring. We didn't protect them from the people at the level of the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government. We didn't protect our minds from those people, and they took over the education system. And over this 200-plus years of history, since the 1778, or 87, I should say, and all of that, we have let our subjects, the Congress, the executive branch, and the judicial, they are our subjects, and we have let them get control of our minds in this country. And they have taken over the position as the sovereigns in this country. And I've heard judges in the court say things to that effect. And so there's, you know, I think that's very basic. Now, when we the sovereigns, when we wake up and go back and you might say we have to wash our brains. Now, in the past, we've always thought of brainwashing as something that the enemy does to us, wash our brains. Well, that's not, they're not washing our brains when they, put this false education in there about the sovereignty and how that we have to obey their laws. Well, we're subject to their laws. They're dirty in our minds. They're filling our minds with garbage. They're filling our minds with propaganda, which is nothing more than, lies that are covered up with verbiage and one thing another. Rather than call them a lie, well, they call it propaganda. And of course now in the schools it's called education, and so we the people, we have to learn what it means to be sovereign, and the fact that we cannot protect our sovereignty as individuals. That's something we have to learn, and we have to understand that sovereignty only comes about when we are sovereign and we protect the sovereignty of our neighbor, our families. We have to protect each other's sovereignty. You cannot protect your own sovereignty by yourself. If the rest of the civilization out there around you, if they are subjects, they're not going to let you be sovereign. They can't do that.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah, they aren't going to let you be sovereign. You have to have this understanding amongst the people that we protect each other's sovereignty, and that's where the grand jury, that's where the trial jury, the petit jury, that's where they come into being. And we have to get across to the American people that we have to protect each other from these traffic laws where the municipals, the counties and such, and the state highway patrols are using the traffic laws as a way of collecting another tax. They're using that to collect taxes. They're no better than the highwaymen that we had back in Montana in the 1860s. when they would go out and hold up the stagecoach, they'd find out if that stagecoach was carrying some gold from the gold mines, and they would hold up the stage and steal the gold, and they were highwaymen. And we've got these guys out there now, and they've got their strange hats. I've seen a lot of them in at the state capitol in Olympia today. They had an extra force of them there because they were not too pleased with what we were doing there. But they got a badge, and they've been brain damaged with all of the education, what they call education, which is nothing more than brain manipulation and brain programming, and it's the wrong kind of programming. So with that, I'll let Terry and Gary pick up from there.
Reddit is, you know, as a criminal lawyer, I do a lot of traffic. I represent a lot of people on DUIs, driving under suspension.
Sure.
You know, and at first, it was when I started in the DA's office in 1990, you know, I just had gotten out of law school, and I just never thought about it. It was the law, you did it, and, you know, you did your function as either a police officer or a judge or a DA or a defense attorney or a juror or whatever the case may be. But it was right at that time that Mothers Against Drunk Driving were really putting the squeeze on, and, you know, states were changing their laws and making tougher laws. And I remember trying my first year as a DA, 25 DUIs. And since that time, I probably, out of the 300-some-odd jury trials I've done, probably 150 of them have been DUIs. And I have witnessed, I have personally witnessed how the ever-increasing traffic laws have literally destroyed the Constitution. Now, you would think that wars would destroy the Constitution, you know, or political strife would destroy the Constitution. Riot. No, it's been traffic laws. People are scared to get in their car. People are scared to drive down the street. People are scared to engage in commerce because everywhere you go, you're getting stopped. You're getting searched. You're getting handcuffed. You're getting pulled out. Blood is being extracted from your arm. You've got to blow in some machine down at the station. And let me tell you right now, as a father of two small children, I've represented a number of different people on vehicular homicide, vehicular assault, and it is the worst thing in the world. It is the worst thing in the world for to have to just witness the process of a family who's lost a loved one and a defendant who is a regular person, but they got drunk and killed somebody. It is the most senseless crime in the world. So I'm not here to stand up for that. I'm not here to say that it's good that people go drink and drive. But in the end, it's been an abysmal failure. People are still dying by thousands. But in the meantime, millions of people have done millions of years in jail for not hurting anybody, for not hurting a soul, for having a license plate light out, or for having a tail light out, or for speeding, or for allegedly weaving. And in the end, there's no victim. There's no victim in a driving under revocation case. There's no victim in a standard DUI case. And certainly if there is a victim, well, then you have to be charged, and you have to be prosecuted, and you have to be punished. But we have spread out these victimless crimes to spend the driver's licenses of millions of people, to then make our roads less safe, because people without driver's licenses, although they can go get insurance, it's not really effective when you go to collect. And we just haven't trained our population. Just like you said, Red, we haven't trained our children. We haven't trained our high school kids. We could cut down on the number of alcohol-related deaths almost in 1 year if we would just stop jailing everybody and just go to the high schools, and which I know is already done, but really lay it out to people. Really spell it out. Hey, listen, it's not good to drink and drive, you know, but if you kill somebody, you're going to prison, and you're going to prison for a long time. But on the other hand, you've got to be personally responsible. I don't know if it's ever going to happen, but we need to really, as states, really, if we do come to a point ever in our history that we take back our state houses, we need to reexamine these traffic laws. We need to reexamine the millions of dollars that we're putting into traffic enforcement, the millions of dollars that it's taken to put these fancy police cars out there and train all these officers and to do all these things. I'd rather they focus on bank robberies. I'd rather they focus on sexual assaults. I'd rather they focus on burglars. I'd rather they focus on murderers. I really would. I think they need to leave us alone. They need to leave us alone. And if an accident happens, well, the police are going to get called. And there's going to be a victim, and there's probably going to be a defendant. And that person's in a lot of trouble. But up until that time, I mean, I drove by a little area today, and there were four state patrol officers that had pulled over four different people. And I'm sure when those tickets were written, they went right back up to their positions and got the next four in line. And it's just on and on and on and on and on. And it's just like Red said, it's a form of taxation. It's not about highway safety. It's not about traffic safety. It's about giving somebody a job, for one, and getting the money out of a citizen so that four or five other people can have a job down at the courthouse or down at the station or down at the jail or wherever it may be. And this big, huge monstrosity of a bureaucracy has grown up around all these tickets and all these charges. Terry, you can't even park in the Jefferson County Courthouse. There's no parking in the Arapahoe County Courthouse. Go down to Denver, try to find a parking space. Go to Adams County, park up, a quarter of a mile away from the courthouse. The dockets are completely overloaded. I'd venture to say if you talk to any criminal defense attorney across this state, they will tell you that their dockets are completely and utterly overloaded. And that's not because we haven't built enough courthouses. That's because the system is trying to keep itself alive, and this is how they do it.
Hey, Gary?
Yes, sir.
Did you see that that judge in Indiana that was, or I might have been even a town council or somebody, but they came out and they were trying to put people in jail, finding them in contempt for demanding a jury trial
right.
on traffic violations.
Right. Yeah.
What would happen? I'm curious. What would happen if all the people in the state of Colorado started not paying their tickets before a hearing and going in and demanding a jury?
Well, you don't get a jury trial for a traffic infraction like a speeding ticket, but you get a trial to the court. You know, let's see them do 100 trials to the court a day. And if it did get up to past careless driving, which is just a 4-point violation, much less a reckless driving or no proof of insurance or DUI. It's still misdemeanor level, but carries 90 days in jail or 180 days in jail or a year in jail like a DUI does. All those people have a right to a jury trial. Those are all, quote-unquote, criminal cases. And as defense attorneys, sometimes our only option is to set a case for trial. Because, you know, the DAs, because of the political nature, they're getting tougher and tougher and tougher. You know, they're under the gun to not wind up on some political commercial, you know, two or three years down the line. And so living it every day, I lived it today, I'll live it tomorrow, I'll live it next Tuesday when we go back to work. The public side has absolutely no idea how much they are pressuring the private side. And the private side is just squealing. The private side is screaming uncle But the public side just keeps cranking it and cranking it and cranking it and cranking it. And they just go about their merry way. Their check comes in the mail every month. Their pension is funded every month. Their health care is funded every month. They get every conceivable holiday off. They work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. They never have to make payroll, right? You have to make payroll. And I'm not complaining about public servants. I'm just stating the fact. But they have no idea how hard it is out here on the private side, how hard it is to make payroll if you have a small business, how hard it is to fill out all these forms and pay all these taxes and to keep your family alive and to keep your business alive. We don't get a free check in the mail every month. We don't get our pension funded even if we have them funded every month. And the way they keep it going is by doing what we're talking about. Keep passing out those tickets. Get them in the system. You know how much money Terry, how they make money off prisoners. You know what they do. It's dirty. It's a dirty business. They take out bonds on these prisoners. They take out insurance policies on these prisoners. They trade derivatives. It's a sick business. And I like Red's approach. If we could get to the population, if we could somehow empower the population so that when you got on a jury, you wouldn't raise your hand like a fool and start talking about how you can't be fair because you believe in jury nullification or you don't agree with your government. That's the first juror that's knocked off every single case. Raise your hand and say, yes, I can be fair. I can be very fair. Right? You see what I'm saying? You get these jurors,
absolutely.
Like they want to go home. And I know they're trying to be honest, but it's just as honest to say, I can be fair. Mr. Jones, can you follow the law? Oh, yeah, I can follow the law. Will you hold the prosecution to her burden? Oh, I'll hold her to her burden. Can you give this scumbag defendant a fair trial? I can give him a very fair trial. You see what I'm saying? Instead, you get the homogenous juror because all the people that really know what it's like to be a juror have been kicked off hours ago. So in the end, I think Red's got it. We gotta educate the population so that other than just voting or protesting or writing or speaking or whatever you got to do when you get that juror summons, that's your chance. That's your chance to go down there and express your sovereignty and protect a fellow citizen. If they're guilty, you're going to find them guilty. That ain't the problem. But if it's something that you know is not right, and there's no victim, and nobody got hurt, you got the power in your hands. You got justice in your hands. And it's up to you as that one juror in six or one juror in 12, when you get back there in that room, teach those other people. They know it instinctively. They know it. They know it. They just need to be told. They just need to be educated. The judge ain't going to do it. The judge ain't going to do it. The DA's not going to do it. The defense attorney will try, but he'll get shot down. You know that.
Well, Gary, you know, Red was one of the, he actually inspired the founding of the Fully Informed Jury Association. And I put the web address for FIJA, the Fully Informed Jury Association, on in the chat room. And I would urge everyone to go and look at their information about, being a responsible juror and what your rights are as a juror. And for sure, do not allow any judge to ever tell you you do not have the right to judge the law, because you do. And I was at a meeting last Sunday that I spoke at down in Colorado Springs. We had a pretty full house there at in the meeting room at the Penrose Library. And even that guy that's on his 52nd day of the hunger fast was there with us. Sean was there trying to draw attention to the Articles of Freedom, which, of course, Gary, you made a contribution to for the eligibility clause language that we put into the Articles of Freedom. And I want to thank you for coming to St. Charles on your own nickel and helping us out a little bit the few days that you were there. But at any rate, down there in Colorado Springs at that meeting, I'm talking to these folks, and it was just interesting that I threw up some of the red stuff about, you know, the hierarchy of the Creator and then we the people under natural law and being above the Constitution. It was interesting to see the reaction that I was getting from these people, because they were really excited about the fact that as a juror we can actually do something. We don't have to wait till the next election in
right.
order to vote.
Right.
And so FIJA has got a lot of great information out there for people to go and research and learn about and teach your kids.
Right.
You know, keep them out of school one day a month and watch what happens to we need to actually organize that. But it would be great if we did some homeschooling at least one day a month and got with other other parents and learned about constitutional issues and what the principles of the Constitution are and taught them to our kids, and at the same time started getting to know some of the other kids' parents and building a network of people who are really into basic constitutional governance. And there's just so much we can do to be responsible, and there's so much more than waiting, you know, once every 2 or 4 years to go to a ballot box.
Right. It is true. It's a daily. There's a moment every day somewhere to express your sovereignty. Every day there's a moment that you can appropriately and in the most professional and polite way express your sovereignty, either to a friend or to a police officer that's even just talking to you, or maybe pulling you over, or a jury service, or water cooler conversation, or whatever it may be. There's always a moment where you can, in the most appropriate, humble way, express your sovereignty, because I'm very encouraged that we're reaching a tipping point, and the population is starting to wake up. They really are.
I'd like to inject something here. I just had a conversation here a couple of weeks ago with the executive director for the Fully Informed Jury Association. She said that in the past year they know of at least 20 cases or more that were influenced. It was a fully informed jury that made a big difference in somebody's life. This tells me that we're gaining, because this just hasn't happened in the past here, and this education process is very much it's going on, and people are going to put millions and I suppose billions of dollars into the election process of picking legislators and senators and such for next November, the midterm elections. I would recommend that people don't give even one nickel or one skinny dime to a Democrat or a Republican candidate for office. I think that that money would be much, much better spent with the Fully Informed Jury Association, because they have this tremendous amount of good information. They have these pamphlets that are really very well done, professionally put together, very, very attractive on gun control, and they've got one, a DVD out now for the ministers in the churches. And she told me that they have a list of churches that are waiting and want copies of that DVD so that they can teach this truth in their pulpits, where it belongs. And of course, here we run into a problem with the corporate church, the 501c3 contracts,
right,
with the Internal Revenue Service and such.
Right. Right.
And of course, you know, people just do not comprehend that the first clause of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law having anything to do with the religious community. I can't remember the exact wording here. But anyway, the church, the pastor in that pulpit, was to be as much of a check against you know, criminal government,
sure.
Evil and wicked government is a term that I prefer to use. You know, our system of checks and balances. When we went to that government school, they said the legislative branch of government was to be a check against the executive, and the judicial branch, and the executive branch was to be a check against the legislative and the judicial branch. The judicial branch was to be a check against the legislative and the executive branch. Well, we all know that those three branches of government are not being checks one against the other. Well, you know, this is what's so fantastic about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, because the church was to be a check. They did tell us in that government school that the free press, that they were to be a watchdog, you know, overseeing and critiquing what government was doing. Well, the church was to be a watchdog. The free press, the free speech, the freedom to assemble, the freedom to petition for redress of grievance, those are all critical checks that are in our hands. The jury is a check. The grand jury is a check. We've got all of these checks against the government, and we're not using them because we have never been taught. We have never, we lost that somewhere back there, because this thing, this problem that we're involved in right now evolved over a period of over 200 years. And so I want to add one more thing, Terry, before we go off this, finish this program tomorrow, tonight, because I have a theory that I want to throw out there. And so it'll go right with what we're doing, talking about tonight. Are you there?
We're here.
Yeah, go ahead, Red. We're waiting for this theory.
Well, you know, I keep hearing amongst the Tea Party people and the Oath Keepers and the Continental Congress people and such, and I hear all this about the Second Revolution, American Revolution. And I really think this is incorrect. I think that what we have to recognize is that there has been, you know, I've said it many times, but I think we need to really stress this, the fact that there has been, the Second Revolution has been going on ever since the Constitution and Bill of Rights were ratified. We had people back then that were, they were trying to destroy the principle of where the people would be sovereign, and that the government would be a servant. That, boy, I'll tell you, we've had them all down through our history of 200 plus years. We've had those that have been determined to destroy this political system where we, the people, are the sovereigns. And I think they were conducting a revolution, and I think we lost it. I think they won. That's how bad it is in this country right now. And so we're fighting back. We're involved in the third American Revolution. We're trying to take it back. We're trying to redeem that which we lost. And, you know, getting back to this, you know, the DUIs and such, you know, it was our misbehavior as the sovereigns that brought about the DUI laws, because, well, I remember when driver's license, we didn't have driver's license, and then when we did get a driver's license law, it was 50 cents. But what brought about that was that we had somebody out there that was so irresponsible, they went and got themselves boozed up, went out on the highway, and they hurt somebody. And so you've got somebody that's laying in the hospital, and they've been damaged, they've been injured, they've been hurt, and because somebody was irresponsible. And so they are laying there in the hospital being put back together, and they call in their state legislator, state senator, and say, hey, we've got to do something about these drunks on the highway. We've got to do something. Well, it gave the legislative branch of government the excuse to create a law that was restrictive, that would collect revenue, and that type of thing. So almost all of these laws that we've got on the books, the traffic laws especially, I guess, are there because some of us have a tendency to be irresponsible. We did it to ourselves, and you see, we haven't governed ourselves. We have depended on the government to make us behave, and you know, that's putting it rather crudely, perhaps, but we just haven't recognized that it's our misbehavior, our practice of violating other people's other sovereigns. We're violating, we're causing damage to them, and so the state, they try to make corrections. And so, you know, that's part of what we're into right now, where, I mean, it's a lot of it right now where we're at. And, of course, the third American Revolution, I think we need to call it that, and I think we need to say, hey, there has been a revolution going, and we lost. I think that the American people would be easier to deal with and educate if we were to explain this to them about how that there were those people that got themselves into positions where they could dominate and take control, and we allowed it to happen. We did it to ourselves, and, of course, this revolution number two, here it was going on all around us, and we weren't smart enough to recognize, we weren't intelligent enough, or educated enough, I guess I should say, informed enough to recognize that we were under an attack. We have been attacked, and of course, there's more than one way to fight a war. And subversion, of course, Cicero, he talked about it back there a couple thousand years ago, almost. And he said that great nations, they're not destroyed from without. They're destroyed from within. That's the only way you can destroy a great nation, is with an enemy in within. And, of course, this is why the oath of office that all public servants are required to take, they were to defend the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. Nobody talks about the domestic. We talk about, we're taught about the foreign enemies, and they're not near as dangerous as the domestic enemies. But nobody is teaching you about the domestic enemies, because it's the domestic enemies that are, you know, they're very intelligent people usually, and they're a minority. They are a minority. There's more of us out there. There's over 200 million of us that are armed to the teeth out there at this point in time. And of course, that's the first step, I guess, in sovereignty. regaining our sovereignty is making sure that we are armed to the point where we can defend our rights if we have to get into that kind of a situation. But I better pipe down here for a bit. But I just think that we need to talk about the third American Revolution, because the second has been going on for over 200 years.
Well, I couldn't agree more.
Gary,
I think it's are you still with me?
I'm here.
Yes.
I hate to talk about conspiracy theories. I hate that word, and it wouldn't be such a bad word if it would just hadn't been drugged through the mud so much. But there's no question that the sovereigns of Europe have been at us since the beginning. They knew the dangers of having this great country compete with them. They knew the dangers of revolution in their own country, French Revolution, Russian Revolution. They knew that the strength of the people. And they knew that if sovereignty was expressed in the way that it was meant to be in this country, that it would have contagiously affected the rest of the world. It was incumbent upon the sovereigns of Europe to destroy this country. And they are still doing it to this very day. They're apt to destroy our dollar. I mean, this is what this is all about. They've destroyed our family. I never really bought that. I never really got like, oh, what do you mean they're trying to destroy the family? I don't even understand what that means. But now that I understand the importance of family, of understanding your family, of understanding where your family came from, understanding what your family put into this country, now I know why. It's incumbent upon those who want to destroy this country to destroy the family. As Red mentioned, it's incumbent upon those who want to destroy sovereignty in this country to impact the ability of preachers to speak to their congregation. And they have. They've throttled them. You can't speak politically in a church environment. I would suggest that's why you go to church, to talk about your community, to talk about your kingdom, to talk about sovereignty, to talk about rules and morality. I don't know how you could separate politics from that. But they've craftily done it. The income tax is just been used to destroy us. I get up and work every day, all day, until I go home and go to sleep. And then I get up and I work every day, all day. And it's just all anyone can do to make enough money to pay their bills, feed their family, and have a couple of dollars left over for a movie. A sovereign should be engaged in research, archery, getting themselves in shape, having enough time to do some writing. That's why we're put on this earth, to flourish, to be creative. All we do is work. All we do is slave. All we do is make enough money so that we can barely live. That's not what the sovereign's supposed to do. We don't even have money, Terry. We don't even have money. How can you be a sovereign without money? All we've got's paper. It's a pathetic situation. But now that we're getting these concepts out there, now that we're starting to seed this situation, and these free people that live in this country that really want to be free, are starting to understand that the only thing that's standing between them and freedom is their own government. I think they're starting to figure it out. It might take 50 years, this third revolution. It might take 50 years. It might take 100 years. But it's a battle worth fighting for. And what I like to say, and you only got about 10 minutes left, but, back in the day, they meant what they said when they said, give me liberty or give me death. They meant that, and we have to mean that. This is scary business. I don't want any problems from the government. I don't want to be arrested. I don't want to be jailed. I don't plan on putting in myself in a position to have to do that. But that's what we're risking. We're risking our fortunes. We're risking our lives and we're risking our liberties. But we have to. It's a call to arms. It's a call up. Red, I know you've been working on this forever. You probably have been very frustrated throughout the 80s and the 90s and the early part of the 21st century trying to get people to listen. They're starting to listen now, aren't they?
Well, I knew that it was going to take an economic breakdown, meltdown, to get the people to where their hearing would improve to the point where they could hear what we were saying. And we're there right now. I'm just glad that I'm still here to see it, because you know, I just knew over the years that we were not reaching the number of people that we should. And of course, the videos that we have produced and the books that I've been able to put out there, I say that after I'm gone, I'm still going to be able to kick butt with the books, because they're going to go on. I my first book has been out now 30 years this year, and it's still in print. And this is highly unusual for a book to be still be in print after that many years. And it's because now people read that and they just say, oh man, I know this is correct. I know this is right, and so they want others to read it too. And I don't have a publisher because I didn't dare sign a contract with a publisher, because there are very good books that have been put on the shelf by publishers where the author wrote the book and thought that the way he had to go about it was, get a publisher involved. Well, the publisher reads the book and they say, well, we can't let this book out there, because this would wise up the American people to what's happened to them. And because most of these publishers, I think, are on the other side, on the winning side of Revolution Number 2, and so they'll buy the rights for the book and say that they're going to publish it and all, and it goes on the shelf and it never is published. It's never put out there for public consumption. And I know that's happened. I've had people tell me about how they've done this writing and such, and then had it more or less hijacked. And so I'm a self-publisher, and it's worked out quite well for us, because we sell a lot of books by the case, because people will read a book and say, hey, I want to get some of those books out. I'll never forget when my first book came out. They came in cartons of 100, and there was a farmer down in Kansas. He bought 100 of them and went out on the street corner in the city or the town that he was close to and handed out 100 books right on the street corner on a Saturday. And in Colorado, up in the high country there, my little book, Walls in Our Minds, there was a fellow up there that bought 2,000 of those. And he said every public servant in the county that he lived in was going to have a copy of that little book. So, you see, truth has, there's people out there that are attracted to truth. And so we've got to put the truth out there. And right now, with people hurting financially and everything, their hearing is a lot better than it was before the real estate balloon burst. And so it's happening, and we need to, be involved. We need to be available so that we can help people get their brains washed of all the garbage and all the propaganda. The fancy lies that they call propaganda. Propaganda is a lie that they sell as truth, and it's fake truth. It's not truth. And so, anyway, I enjoy the program tonight, Gary. I'm so glad that we've got some attorneys in this country that are waking up with everybody else. You and Steve Pigeon, I don't know if you've communicated, but you need to communicate with one another.
I will.
This guy, he really amazed me today with how he handled this thing, and he's just as blunt as he can be. And so, but you're on the same wavelength. You're working with us on the same problems, the sovereignty thing. And, boy, you guys can be effective.
Well, let me spend the last couple of minutes, Terry, just talking about the seminar here. I don't even know. I'd call it a presentation, seminar, lecture, whatever you want to do. I'm going to be at the University of Denver School of Law. That's Strum Hall or Strum School of Law. That's the University of Denver. That's Saturday, January 30th. And that's right on University and Evans. And there's plenty of parking on a Saturday. We'll have food and snacks available. And we're billing it as 8 to 5, but it's really more like 9 to 4. We want everybody to get there and sort of mill around a little bit, and there'll be a full hour and a half lunch. And I'm trying to just create an environment where, yeah, there's some presentation in the middle and in the end, but I'm just trying to get everybody together to exchange email addresses and talk, and trying to bring some of the older patriots in with the newer crowd. I'm also going to be at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska on February 13th. I'm going to be at University of Southern California on February 20th, University of Texas at Austin on March 6th, University of Washington up there in Seattle on March 20th. Maybe that's an opportunity that I can meet with Stephen. And Tulane University on April 3rd, University of Alaska Anchorage on April 24th. So I've got a rather lengthy schedule that I'm marching through here, and I'm just going to be on the road every other weekend at some university, some law school. Because they're all set up with the PowerPoint presentations and the screens that drop down, and you know there's a cathedral or auditorium style seating for 90 to 100 people at most of these schools. So I'm getting my site together. I had a web designer that just didn't do the job for me. But everything tomorrow will be up on gigisup.net. The schedule will be up. I'm emailing this flyer around. But the big one is to just get it kicked off at the University of Denver Strum School of Law on January 30th. That's Saturday here in 2 weeks. And then more information about the other ones as they go along will be emailed to people and blasted out there over the cyberspace.
Well, we the people of Colorado, we the people of Congress of Colorado has an email list of about 1,000 people around the state, Gary, and I know that David would be glad to put out a blast for you. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind if I bring a bunch of copies of the Articles of Freedom and give people the opportunity to sign the pledge.
I think there'll be a lot of people. You know, I just love those We Are Change guys and gals. They're young, they're energetic. You know, they get the word out, and they don't really know what's happening. With us older folks, you know, going and doing what we're doing, and for guys like Red that have been doing it for decades. So part of the programs, part of the sovereignty issue is to try to get the young and the old together. So, yeah, bring it, because you're gonna see about 30 or 40 people that are 25 and under at the sovereignty conferences, because the We Are Change has chapters in every state, and now they're blossoming all over the world. Because this liberty issue is contagious, and young people are starting to wake up. They're starting to really wake up because they feel it, and they're not all radicals. They're not all liberals. Many, many young people, as I think Ron Paul figured out quickly, are way into this freedom movement, and they understand it, and they don't want to be slaves anymore, and they see it. They see the writing on the wall. So yeah, bring what you can. Bring videos, bring books. Let's bring 20 of Red's books and stick them up in the back and sell them for whatever he wants to sell them for. And you know, let's just keep this thing going.
That's great. I've got some here, and I'm sure Red would send some more if we need them. But
that'd be great.
Any rate, did you meet Schaefer Cox in St. Charles?
Yes, I did. I've got that the Alaska scheduled for April 24th. Of course, I grew up in Alaska.
Well, you,
but,
throw you,
you better be there.
Gary, our 2 hours is up. Red, thank you, Gary. You were a great guest, and we want to have you back soon. So, looking forward to January 30th. Great group of listeners we've got tonight.
Thank you, guys.
I'll say good night to the audience.
Yep.
See you
good
next
night.
Week.
Thanks, Red. Thanks, Terry.
Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down, tell him that God's gonna cut you down, tell him that God's gonna cut you down.